Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
There's nothing we can really do. We can't go really unwrap them, especially if we think about a full field of tassels being wrapped up or just delayed out. They'll eventually come out, but those silks, really what's receptive to the pollen, are only viable for a few days. And if we think about heat and it being in some portions of the state being dry, I know we've been kind of getting some spotty rain, those silks will not be receptive to the pollen if they dry out. So every silk that is not pollinated, that is, we are losing kernels.
Talking corn production issues, Kansas State Extension agronomist Tina Sullivan.
Because again, silks are going to be more at our eye level, whereas the tassel is above. And if it's not out and shedding pollen, then it's not doing its job.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins on Wednesday announcing USDA undergoing a major reorganization in an effort to reduce cost while aligning more closely with its core mission of serving farmers, ranchers, and foresters. She says the workforce grew by 8% over the last 4 years and salaries up over 14%. Leadership claims those increases unsustainable and didn't translate into better service. So the response? USDA will begin relocating many of its Washington-based employees to 5 regional hubs: Raleigh, Kansas City, Indianapolis, Fort Collins, and Salt Lake City. Now, the department also plans to vacate or repurpose several buildings in the national capital, citing high cost and underuse. Only about 2,000 USDA employees will remain in the region once the relocation is complete. Well, Brazil making strides toward competing with the U.S. and Japan's premium beef market. Recent genetic and nutritional improvements in Brazil's cattle industry narrowing the gap in beef quality. Historically known for lean, grass-fed cattle, Brazil now investing heavily in crossbreeding and grain-based finishing. Angus genetics have surged in popularity, with British breeds comprising a third of all beef sales in 2024. More than 14.6 million cows artificially inseminated. And on the nutrition front, Brazil's feedlot capacity grew to over 8 million head last year. That's a 25% increase in 5 years. President Trump's aggressive trade strategy continues reshaping global markets. The U.S. has finalized a landmark agreement with Japan, eliminating tariffs and opening the door to $550 billion in Japanese investment. 90% of profits from that production will remain in the U.S., while imports subject to a 15% tariff. Now, trade agreements also finalized with Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, UK, and Australia. European Union negotiations appear close to resolution. Australia wants a trade barrier holdout, is also allowing American beef greater access after years of non-tariff restrictions. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says no country wants to be locked out of U.S. markets. The administration sees the Japanese deal as a model, believing moderate tariffs paired with strong U.S. advantages create winning conditions for American producers and consumers. Well, U.S. ag exports have delivered more than just strong overseas sales. They generate a total of $362.4 billion in domestic economic activity. That's according to USDA's Economic Research Service. In 2023, the trade multiplier model used by ERS shows that each dollar of ag exports generates $2.06 in total economic output in the U.S. economy. Now, the exports support jobs and services well beyond the farm gate, boosting demand for transportation, packaging, finance, and logistics across the ag supply chain. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think it's always important when we talk about leaders and leadership to recognize that they do come in different types, right? We can have those that have the formal title, but oftentimes within a group of people, there's that informal leader who's very influential, that's very much leading that group of individuals. And, you know, whether that's a thought leader or leading them towards a mission or whatever that mean, an objective that's down the road, I think that's an important thing to recognize, is those different types of leaders that are out there.
Justin Wagner is a Kansas State beef cattle specialist. He authored a recent article on leadership.
So I'd come across a few years ago Simon Sinek, and for those of you that aren't familiar with, he's got a lot of just great content that's on the web, some short YouTube videos. He's kind of a leadership and business consultant is really what he does. And so he defined leadership and really put two performance versus trust, right? Those are two important characteristics in a leader. And so he essentially created a graph, if you will. We have two scales. We have performance on one scale and we have trust on another scale. And so you have performance that could be high performance to low performance, and then you have trust from low to high as well. And so if we kind of picture these four quadrants of this performance versus trust graph, you know, those are two things as we start to think about leaders, right? And the ideal leader that we would have out there would be an individual that obviously is high performing, but also is high trust, because in order for that group of individuals or that team to be more engaged, we have to have a high level of trust, right? We have to be able to build up within those individuals. We have to know, do they have my back? Are they going to support me? And so I think that's why trust is, you know, fairly important as we think about that. And so as we think about that ideal leader, right? High performance, high trust, right? But on the other side of the spectrum, we've also got a individual that could be a leader that is very high performing, but low trust. And so in that particular, if you go online, you find some of these resources from Simon Sinek. One thing you see is he defines that person that is essentially low trust, but high performing as a toxic leader. They are all about the mission and objective. They have more of a me attitude and a little bit less of a we attitude. So that's one spectrum of that is probably not what we're looking for in a leader. Okay. On the other side of that, that ideal leader that's high performing, but high trust, that is a leader that, you know, really long term is going to keep the objective, whatever that skill is that, you know, we're working towards. They have a high degree of ability to perform at a given level, but they can also build trust within that team so that that team begins, it elevates the team as well. Okay. So you get a high level of engagement. And just like all things, there's a spectrum, right? And so in drawing experiences from, you know, data from the military, you know, you start thinking about, well, okay, we're not always going to find this ideal leader, right? We're not always going to find this individual that's high performing, but yet instills a high degree of trust. And really what Sinek describes in his video is that oftentimes a leader that may be moderate on the scale of performance, but yet is very good at trust and building trustworthiness within the team, in the long run, they're going to be more effective than that leader that is simply more about the performance objectives. And so I think the take home message of the article that I put together was really, I think oftentimes in an organizational structure, we select leaders based on their performance criteria. And we tend to maybe put a little less value on the trust side of things because quite honestly, it's harder to quantify, right? How do you quantify trust? And so I think that's an important characteristic just to start to think about, hey, there are some soft skills that go into a leader that it's not necessarily just about all of the performance measures. You know, did they meet their sales goals for the month, et cetera? You know, there's lots of ways we can define performance, especially as we get out into the business world.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the things I don't think we talk enough about is the land grant institutions and research, and then the extension that has to come with that research for our ag communities to produce the products that we all depend on being on the shelves when the other 98 or 99% of Americans that aren't involved in agriculture go to the grocery store.
At a recent House Ag Committee hearing on future innovations in crop protection, Georgia Representative Austin Scott.
With that said, and again, going back to the land grant institutions, how can industry and producers more effectively partner with the land grant institutions to not only accelerate the development of these technologies, but ensure their practical deployment on the farm? And what additional support or policy initiatives might strengthen these collaborations to benefit both the innovation and the extension that's necessary for farmer adoption?
I think the first thing that we can do is recognize the role that extension does play in new product discovery, new ingredient discovery, workforce development. I'm sure in this committee there's many of you had a stint in an extension lab at some point doing research, or maybe had a where it took a class for an extension professor. So I think recognizing that the extension's role in the supply chain process and in the innovation process is key. And I know my extension colleagues, you know, they're sometimes strapped for that funding they need to do the work. And I think what we could do is help, you know, give back to those extension researchers and make sure that they're getting the work done in the field that needs to get done.
We see in California, we have the University of California and we have the University of California Ag and Natural Resources Department. We know that the research done on many of the land-grant colleges and universities does get transformed to the growers through the Ag Extension Service. We have relationships with them on farm, and we actually work with some of the researchers directly with the universities to do cutting-edge technology on our farm so that we can show other people some of the new advances that can be applicable really throughout California and the world. So having the connection between the university and the advisors is critical for getting information out to growers.
Mr. Abbott, I'm going to come to you with another question if I can, down to a minute and a half, but I do want to express one other concern that I have, and it is the accumulation of this technology by China through ChemChina and I think we're being naive as Americans to think that allowing somebody who is now our no longer an aggressive economic competitor but actually an adversary to control the chemicals that we need in the food supply chain, that that's not going to come back to bite us. Mr. Abbott, in your testimony, you provided an overview on the challenging delays occurring at the EPA related to the regulatory review. I know you spoke to this, but with more than $500 million in post-patent formulation improvement products stuck in that review, can you elaborate to the committee why timely access to these innovations is just as important, if not more important, than the new chemistry?
Because it puts us in a better spot. We need to remain competitive, because otherwise we just hand it over, to your point, the Chinese, right? They're going to come in and they're going to take no prisoners, so to speak, to paraphrase there. So I think to get our growers in a competitive situation, we need to make sure we continue to quickly push those through, especially when the chemistries have been around for quite some time.
Yes, sir. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I look forward to continuing the discussion. I do think hopefully we'll see bipartisan efforts to solve these problems.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
After a comprehensive review of which everyone was aware of both the department's operations and our fiscal standing, I have ordered a complete reorganization of the USDA.
In an announcement on Wednesday to employees of USDA, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins.
President Trump promised to realign federal spending, eliminate duplication and redundancy, and ensure all agencies are efficiently and effectively delivering services to our constituents, of course, here at USDA, the farmer, the rancher, the forester, and the American taxpayer. We are doing just that by moving our key offices, services outside Washington, D.C., to ensure that USDA is located closer to the people we serve, while also providing a more affordable cost of living for our employees and their families. I want to be clear here that this is an announcement of a reorganization, not a large-scale workforce reduction. This reorganization takes into account the employee that made the decision to opt into the Deferred Resignation Program, or our DRP, earlier this year. This reorganization already recognizes that many USDA employees provide critical frontline services in locations all across our great country that cannot be disrupted. We have developed a phased plan to relocate much of the Washington, D.C. area workforce to 5 hub locations while shedding a number of leases and buildings in the National Capital Region. We will also be reducing some regional office management layers and consolidating duplicate functions. The hub locations are as follows. Number 1, Raleigh, North Carolina. Number 2, Kansas City, Missouri. Number 3, Indianapolis, Indiana. Number 4, Fort Collins, Colorado. And finally, number 5, Salt Lake City, Utah. In the D.C. area, USDA will vacate the following office spaces: Braddock Place, Beltsville Agricultural Research Center, or BARC, George Washington Carver Center, the GWCC, and the South Building. USDA will retain offices in the Witten and Yates buildings. As you know, 90% of our employees are already currently located outside of the D.C. area, and this move continues to best position USDA closer to our core constituents. We will carry out this reorganization through a transparent, common-sense process that preserves USDA's critical health and public safety services that the American public relies on. We will do right by the great American people we serve, and with respect to you, the thousands of hardworking USDA employees who so nobly serve our country. In the coming months, and where applicable, my team will be notifying your offices with more information on relocation to one of those 5 regional hubs. American agriculture feeds, clothes, and fuels this nation and the world. We are embarking on a new chapter that will improve our service to the great patriotic farmers, ranchers, and producers that we are mandated to support. While this is a strategic and long-term decision for USDA, I know that for you, this is an immediate and potentially major change. I know that your primary concern at this moment is for you, your families, and your colleagues. I want you all to know that this decision was not entered into lightly. I have been clear from the beginning of my time as secretary that we must reorient this department to better serve the American people and to return to our core mission of serving America's farmers, ranchers, foresters, and producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
When we think about estimating corn yield, we can do that by looking at our individual yield components and then multiplying them together in an equation to calculate a final grain yield.
Kansas State Extension agronomist Logan Simon.
The first step in estimating corn yield is going out and getting an idea of your plant population. And in corn on 30-inch centers, what we do is we go out and we count the number of plants, or better yet, the number of ears, in case we have a couple of plants out there with 2 reasonably sized ears on them, and a 17.4-foot of row stretch. The reason that we do 17.4 feet of row is that that is, on 30-inch rows, 1/1,000th of an acre. And it's, so it makes for easy calculation up to plants per acre. From there, the next question, once we know how many ears we have per acre, is we need to get an idea of the number of kernels per ear. And to do that, what we are going to be looking at is the number of rows of kernels that we have on our corn ear, and then the number of kernels per row that we have, again. And multiplying those together gives us an idea of the total number of kernels that are out there. It is important that folks, as they are counting the kernels that are out there, we're counting those that are forming normally, not necessarily those that are forming abnormally out on either tip at the base or the upper tip of that ear, but really those kernels that are going to form normally and contribute to yield. And then lastly, once we know how many kernels are basically how many kernels per acre are out there, we need to get an idea of what we think our basically like our test weight is going to be, or our density of those kernels. And so when we think about an excellent large, you know, kernel, what that means is that we have fewer kernels fitting inside a bushel as a unit of volume. So when the kernels are bigger, right, we fit fewer kernels in a bushel unit, where if our kernels are smaller, then we're fitting more of them in there. And so when we calculate the value we would use for kernels per bushel, then that's going to be a much larger number just because the kernels are small. For corn, we usually say that for an excellent crop where we've got really good dense kernels, thick kernels that are out there, we would estimate about 75,000 kernels per bushel, where as we approach something that's more poor, we don't have that same thickness of our kernels, we might shift that to more like 105,000 kernels per bushel, just because they're smaller that are out there. By multiplying our plants per acre, or ears per acre rather, by our kernels per ear, by our kernels per bushel, or dividing rather by kernels per bushel, we're able to calculate our final yield in bushels per acre, which can give us an idea of where our yield potential is currently standing. That way, as we think about what remains through the rest of our growing season, we can be using that as an idea. How much really can I afford to put into this crop at this stage, given the inputs I've already spent money on and the potential, you know, the best case scenario potential yield?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Agrigene is an innovative agricultural biotechnology company working to transform how we manage pest species sustainably, precisely, and without reliance on chemical pesticides.
Testifying before a recent House Ag Committee hearing on crop protection, Brian Weathersby, CEO of Agrigene.
Modern agriculture is under increasing stress. Invasive pests, climate-related migration, resistant to pesticides, and environmental concerns are driving the need for safer, more targeted pest control tools. At the same time, the outdated U.S. regulatory system, based on legislation and guidance written decades ago, struggled to accommodate modern biological innovations. Our regulators are often constrained by these outdated frameworks, lacking the authority and tools to flexibly evaluate 21st century technologies, even when they offer far safer and more sustainable alternatives to legacy chemical or genetic products. Agrigene's PG-SIT technology presents a modern evolution of sterile insect technique, a method used for decades to suppress pest populations like Mediterranean fruit fly and the New World screwworm. Traditional SIT uses radiation to sterilize insects, but this process often causes broad, unpredictable DNA damage, reducing male fitness and performance in the field. PG-SIT, by contrast, uses modern gene editing tools like CRISPR to precisely and reliably edit the genes responsible for fertility and female viability, producing sterile males and only sterile males. These males are healthy, competitive, and self-limiting. When released into the environment, they mate with wild females, leading to population suppression without harming non-target species or leaving behind any residues. PG-SIT is species-specific, scalable, and aligned with modern agriculture and ecological priorities. Agrigene's leading application is targeted towards spotted-winged Drosophila, one of the most economically damaging invasive pests in soft fruit crops across North America and Europe. The annual economic impact from SWD in North America alone is around $1 billion. Existing control options for SWD rely heavily on chemical pesticides, the average age of which was introduced widely and used by berry growers is over 42 years old. These insecticides must be applied repeatedly, and as a result, SWD populations have developed resistance. PG-SIT offers a breakthrough alternative. To validate our technology, university researchers at land-grant institutions in Washington, California, Oregon, Michigan, and Minnesota are currently conducting performance evaluation under controlled conditions. These trials, in partnership with leading entomologists and public sector scientists, demonstrate strong institutional support for PG-SIT's real-world potential as a safe, effective, and sustainable pest control method. Despite this progress, regulatory uncertainty continues to limit deployment. Technologies like PG-SIT don't fit neatly within categories defined by outdated laws like FIFRA or Plant Protection Act. Current agency guidance does not provide regulators with the flexibility they need to evaluate modern gene-edited tools based on their precision, safety profile, or ecological behavior. As a result, innovators face costly delays, inconsistent treatment, and significant barriers to commercialization, even for technologies that outperform conventional methods in both safety and effectiveness. Modernizing our regulatory system is not only necessary to bring better tools to growers, but also essential to national preparedness and biosecurity. The U.S. has faced costly disruptive outbreaks of invasive pests such as New World screwworm, Mexican fruit fly, and Mediterranean fruit fly. The next outbreak is inevitable. Without a modern regulatory framework that enables pre-approval and proactive validation of precision biocontrol tools like PG-SIT, we risk being caught unprepared. To fix this, we must update federal legislation agency authority to reflect the realities of 21st century biology, create science-based risk-proportionate pathways that recognize the unique properties of biological and gene-edited pest control tools, enhance interagency coordination is absolutely critical to streamline reviews and eliminate duplication, and then support field validation programs in advance of emergency needs so that safe, effective tools are ready for rapid deployment when threats arise.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There are a few unique things happening.
Tina Sullivan is a Kansas State Extension agronomist.
We're having the phenomenon where the corn may be putting out the silk before the tassel, or the tassel is wrapped up still tightly in leaves, as we've kind of seen both situations. Is it a planting date situation? Is it a variety or cultivar situation? Is it weather dependent? There's a lot of factors going on that we can't control. Can we see a yield hit from the tassel not emerging properly to get pollen to those silks? Yes. In those situations, the silks continue to grow because they're looking for pollen. So then as the silks continue to grow over one another, as some are too long, the ones underneath may not be able to get the pollen.